Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and I am really honored to be joined by two of my business partners, Mr. Greg Conley. He is the founder, CEO of Trifecta Nutrition. They're the largest organic meal delivery company in the world. And another one of my business partners is Aqua Oso, and Chris Peacock. He is the founder and CEO of this company, Aqua Oso, that really aggregates data for making decisions around water and land usage and banking. And today we share their story about the fundraising journey. And I think you're going to enjoy it. It's educational. And I think it might even be a little bit entertaining. So stick around. We have Greg Conley, Chris Peacock. This is the Mark Haney Show. Welcome to the Mark Haney Show. I am here today fired up, and more than that, I think today I'm really looking forward to learning from men, people, leaders, founders that are in the trenches, both at different stages in their journey, but both have this real world experience when it comes to building a business while simultaneously working to get funding from outside sources. And I think we're going to hear some interesting stories, but hopefully some real world takeaways. Today I have Mr. Chris Peacock is in the house. He is the founder and CEO of Aqua Oso. And then we also have Greg Conley, founder, CEO of Trifecta Nutrition. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Thank you much.
Yeah, both of you have been on the show before. Greg, you've shared in the past. We've talked a lot about your marketing approach in building businesses, but today we're focusing on the part that I guess a lot of people are sort of afraid of, and in some ways they're a little intimidated. And so today we're going to unpack the funding strategies and maybe demystify it a little bit. So if I can start off, you're both at different stages. Chris, you just finished a seed round, so congratulations. And then, Greg, you just recently finished a seed round too, right?
No, we did a seed round, then a Series A.
I meant congratulations, your wife is pregnant.
That's what he's got jokes today, folks. I love it. Yes, yes.
So go ahead, Greg, tell us where you're at in your financing journey.
On the personal side, I'm 4 weeks away from having my first son. So that's about 10 times scarier than any private equity firm for me. But
congratulations.
Thank you. But we're I would say at kind of the mid-range growth phase. We're in the nine figures in terms of revenue, which is exciting. And we're at the phase where we're raising what will, technically on paper be our Series B. It's going to be a $60 million round. We've hired William Blair as our investment bank. They've got, 2,500 bankers across 21 offices throughout the U.S. So they're kind of a player in the, I would say, mid-market to upper mid-market of investment bankers. Above them is going to be the Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, et cetera. It doesn't make sense for us to talk to them unless we were raising more than $200 million. They're more like the deal maker or the, global book runner on an IPO or a SPAC or, something along those lines. So Chris, I think we'll be great at kind of giving the incubator, early stage, all of that type of stuff. And then I can fill in the gaps, Series B, and beyond, all the way up to IPO. So we can hopefully paint a picture of the entire growth life cycle and fundraising experience for entrepreneurs.
I love it. So Chris, why don't you walk us through where you're at in your entrepreneurial journey and specifically in the funding journey?
Yeah, for sure. So we just the other day, actually, we closed our Series C round. So we just raised $2 million from a single office, which is really cool. Kind of limits the number of folks on the cap table. Although we have plenty of people on the cap table already from, all of our prior rounds. It's been a hell of a journey, right? Like we started out by bootstrapping the company, my cash, co-founder's cash. We did friends and family. We did tech stars. So we did like a pre-seed round as part of that. And then we started raising money last year, just before COVID. And of course that just took a total sideways, path for all of us. So we took a little bit of a different path in terms of getting some loans, which really helped us out. And then we're kind of back on track with, traditional VC kind of funding, moving the company forward. So we're not quite in like full growth mode. We're still experimenting quite a bit, but we've got some good traction. And so this capital's for that.
So, and this one could, I think these questions, because Greg, you've been there in those early stages where you were thinking about whether to raise money or not and how to raise money, what the pathway might look like. So I think your perspective now, having been, you know, having it more in the rearview mirror, is also important. But like, well, how do you, I guess, decide whether or not to raise money? Who should raise money in the startup space?
I mean, for me, I always tell entrepreneurs that raising capital is to accelerate growth. It is not a situation where you're going to raise capital and then use that money to build a successful business. Nobody is going to give you money if you do not already have traction. The one exception of that is if you're an already very successful entrepreneur that sold a business and you've got amazing relationships and a track record and people believe you can do it. Otherwise, I always direct entrepreneurs to, you know, bootstrap. For us in the beginning, you know, Trifecta has obviously gone on to become, you know, a big success story. But in the beginning, it was maxing credit cards and, you know, exactly like Chris said, friends and family and, you know, really trying to scrape by to be able to pad the coffers a bit in order to deal with the ups and downs of business in general. But for the most part, Trifecta has been funded by growth coming from profit that we've made really building the business. And if you don't have that, you're going to have a very tough road ahead of you raising capital. There are a few exceptions that we should probably talk through on this show, which is things like what I call organized pre-sales, which you can either do on your website or through something like Kickstarter or something like that, where you're trying to sell you know, some sort of widget before you've even made it. Which in some cases, if you're a very savvy marketer, you can pull off, but it is generally very difficult to do. You're usually much better finding a way to get some sort of visibility and traction going. And then at that point, you can say, hey, this is how it's working at a very small scale. If you, investor A, give me money, I can make it at a much larger scale and you can, you know, ultimately drive a lot of, you know, return on your capital from that.
So, Chris, you're a three-time entrepreneur with success in the past. How did you decide to go out and get equity partners? What went into that decision?
Yeah, it really started from the standpoint of, you know, my prior companies had been more consulting. So always driven, revenue was driven by customers and the dynamics of the customers. And like, there's no way you can deploy venture capital into a consulting firm. It doesn't work, right? The numbers, you're upside down. There's no point. The growth isn't fast enough. In this case, we knew we were building a software company and we knew that we wanted some capital to help us scale. But really early on, like we didn't even go out for outside capital until we had our first customer, right? Like we didn't even talk to friends and family about it until we knew that we could put their money to work. And I think every round after that has really been, why are we raising the capital and what can we use it for and how can we deploy it to build the business? I think one of the scariest things is when you have to raise money just to survive, and keep the current team and the lights on. Versus building the business. And I think investors really see through that as well. So every time we've gone out to market to raise money, it's because we've had an inclination and we've done some tests in the market that pointed to being able to leverage cash to continue growing the business in a positive direction.
So from an emotional standpoint, you use the term scary. And I think for most of us, we are intimidated. I mean, are you telling me you have no fear when you go out to, hey, we're going to go raise some money, haven't done it before? Some amount of scariness involved.
Insert expletive terrified. Absolutely. raising money and selling equity in a company that you're starting and then having the weight of other people's capital that you're now responsible for, in addition to, like in my case and Greg, probably your case, your own cash in the company that you know you're not going to see until like the very end, right? You don't get it out really along the way. It can totally be terrifying. And I'll be honest, like a year and a half ago, I had to do like a full mindset around my relationship to money. And like, it really forced me to go through the process of what is my relationship to money? How was I raised around money? What does money mean to me? And until I think you get like a really clear head around it, it can be really hard to go.
Well, okay. Can you elaborate on that? Cause I'm not sure I understand what you mean in terms of this relationship to money.
Yeah, for sure. Like depending on how you're raised, right? Like some people are terrified of money. They think money is the root of all evil. For other people, you know, money represents like this evil capitalistic society over here. For other people, you know, if depending on how they were raised and where they came up and the environment that they came from, like money is a scarce thing. And like, I had to kind of shift my mindset from money as a scarcity and a scarce object, and there's only a limited supply of it, to there's an abundance of capital. And if you can tap into the right people and you can leverage that capital to build additional abundance in the world, like it's a big shift in terms of like how you think you can actually deploy the cash in the long term.
That's interesting.
Very psychological and emotional and like weird, you know, weird stuff around it with childhood.
You and I were talking a little before the show about the way you were raised, you know, dad, brother, military background. And I had thought about, I hadn't really thought about talking about this, but the relationship to money and that feeling, I guess. And then also, I mean, I'm kind of curious about your, if anything scares you these days. You've gone through a few rounds, you've had the success. I have to imagine the confidence has been boosted quite a bit.
I mean, I think at every next level, I think Chris is absolutely right. It's a bit of a scary process. I think the thing that's helped me get over, my fear of the process, best of all, is understanding it. I think the scary thing for most entrepreneurs getting into fundraising is they go on the internet and they read stories about venture capitalists, you know, giving them these terrible terms and taking over their companies and firing the CEO. And they're really terrified of bringing on investors because they've heard the worst of the worst, you know, type thing. They don't know the amazing stories, where the founders end up becoming great friends with the venture capitalists and they all make a bunch of money together and change the world for the better. Those tend to be more business stories than like fundraising stories. So for me, you know me, Mark, I'm a huge reading and book nerd. I always recommend at least one book on each one of your podcasts I come on. So for this one, I always recommend to people a book called Raising Venture Capital for the Serious Entrepreneur. It talks through everything in terms of kind of terms, your understanding of, you know, structure of deals. You know, people get their first term sheet and they're like, you know, participating preferred shares with a 1x multiple. Like, what does that even mean? You know, then they're like, oh, why does an investor get preferred shares when I'm stuck with common stock? You know, I agree with Chris. There's a lot of psychological stuff in there. People get their ego mixed in and they have trouble empathizing with the position the investor's in, which is, they've done their hard work. They've made their millions of dollars and or raised millions of dollars from their LPs or limited partners to provide their fund. They have to provide a return on that fund. Otherwise, they're going to be a pariah of the venture capital community after that, and they won't be able to raise more money. So yeah, they want certain protections to make sure that they have their best chance of succeeding with their fund. And you'll feel much more comfortable if you understand those protections, understand the terms and the process. And that for me has been able to really allay a lot of my concerns. I mean, even the thought of going public, I think is such an abstract concept to most people. They're like, that's so far away. And for me, I started studying investment bankers. I went on to Udemy and I took the investment banking course. I read tons of articles about investment banking, different books like, The Accidental Investment Banker and, you know, others like that. And I really started to understand, okay, what does it mean to go public? What elements go into taking a company public? Where do these banks come in? What's the difference between an investment bank and a commercial bank and these combined super banks we call universal banks? You know, really understanding all of those elements, I think for me was able to allay a lot of those fears. But, you know, there's still always going to be, some level of, trepidation. I mean, I'm pretty much past the venture capital stage at this point. I mean, we're still going to pitch people like, Andreessen Horowitz and stuff like that because they're so rich, their funds are so big. But, most VCs can't cut a check size in the $60 million range. You know, they could syndicate it maybe, but we're in that kind of mid-market private equity. And there's also private equity that's too high on the top end. So, I've got a great relationship with TSG Consumer, for example, but their most recent fund, they don't cut checks for less than $200 million. So, you gotta know the investor you're approaching at the specific stage you're at and really understand the process, the terms, and the investor's perspective in order to make fundraising as undaunting as you possibly can. Because Chris is absolutely right. It's a daunting, terrifying prospect. I mean, you've created this baby and you're like, selling its leg to somebody.
Well, there's a lot of unknowns, no matter where you're at. But I, Chris, I sort of wonder with where you're at now. You just completed your your seed round. And again, congratulations. But when you think about, I'd say the plan, the overarching plan, you've got, how much equity to sell off, how long in between these rounds, right? How long in between the A and the B and the B1 and, all the different alphabet soup that we could add to this. I mean, how do you, rationalize that there's this unknown, but yet you need to sort of have a plan?
Yeah. I mean, I think so. A couple of things, like Greg, to your point, like understanding the investors and the stage that you're at and how they operate, just like doing customer discovery, just takes so much of the risk profile out of raising capital, because you can go in with like real dialogue versus making guesses and hoping that the investor is going to give you the best deal, which they probably won't, right? Like investors are, they're deal making and you're deal making. And so you come to some realizations. And I think if you go into raising money at any stage and you don't have a plan of attack for what you're going to do with that money and what you might be raising in the future, you're just gonna get trampled all over, right? Like the investors aren't gonna like necessarily see the value that you're creating, or they're not gonna think that you've thought through this enough. And it's hard because I think the holy grail is this is the last round of money we're ever gonna raise because we're gonna get so rich doing what we do. We can just self-fund into perpetuity and become a $100 billion company, right? Like it's rare, but that'd be cool, right? Like I think everyone likes that. I think the way I've always approached it is having optionality. Like I don't ever wanna get to the end of runway and not having the option of, yeah, we're growing fast enough, we can raise money and that money will help us accelerate growth, or shoot, we're not growing fast enough right now, we need to slow it down, we need to get profitable, then we can go figure out how to get fast enough so that it makes sense to take outside capital. Because equity is kind of a funny thing. Like you can grow your equity over time, right? Like you can issue more stocks, you can dilute everybody, like you can continue to like grow the equity side of the business. And I think that's one of the mental components around raising money too, is, you know, I don't know, are you getting diluted over time by your investors, or is your stock price going up? And those are two different ways of looking at the business, right? It's, you know, if you're getting diluted and your stock price is going down, then you're in real trouble. So it's like, what are you trying to optimize for?
So how much should we expect if we're an early stage entrepreneur, there's these different rounds, how much should we expect to be diluted on each of these stages?
Yeah, I think if you're like a really great young entrepreneur and you've got a ton of experience in the space and you're really well known, you can get away with a lot less dilution, maybe do some convertible notes that'll convert at like a $10 million pre-money valuation when you're just at the idea stage. But like for most people, that's not realistic. You know, we probably sold early on 10% of the company when we did friends and family round. We did another 10% of the company in our pre-seed round. In this round, we were like in the 20% range. So there's some standard, right, ways in which of thinking about the business. But again, it's like, what are you optimizing for? Are you optimizing for long-term survivability? Are you optimizing for the best price? Are you optimizing for just a kick-ass group of investors to come in to help you grow the business? And so I think like the dilution component is just one of many elements to look at when thinking about a fundraise.
So the more rounds you go through, obviously there's some dilution in each of these rounds. Plus you've got employees that need typically need some kind of equity component to their salary, to their comp. You've got co-founders potentially. Yep. I mean, how should we think about like, what's the bottom that we might want to get to in order to still have enough influence and enough upside, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it changes over time, doesn't it? At least for me, like the numbers shift is with each round. It's like, the equity component's maybe not as important as it used to be from a control perspective, because it's the, do you want to be rich or do you want to be king paradox over time?
Mm-hmm. Greg, how do you think about that? Obviously you're a little further along. How does that, that question has to have surfaced for you and your co-founders and the other people that are a piece of Trifecta Nutrition?
I think it's a great question. I think it goes back to exactly what we were saying before, kind of educating yourself on the process. You should know, Chris probably went into his fundraise knowing ranges of how much of the company he was willing to sell at that stage. What's, people will use the term what's market a lot, and really having an understanding of, if the company's doing $10 million in revenue and we're raising a $20 million round, we're probably going to give up a pretty solid chunk of the company for that. So I think there's also a balance of like raising the amount of money you need at the stage you need it, which, investors really like to think in milestones of like how we're doing at each individual stage. And there was a word Chris said that I think is extraordinarily important for all the early stage entrepreneurs, any stage entrepreneurs candidly listening to this, and that's the word optionality. What that word means is you are not forced to raise capital. You have options to continue to grow the business. You know, you don't have a gun to your head saying, if we don't raise capital by X date, we're screwed. You know, that's really puts much more of the negotiating power in the investor's corner, because they know you've got to make a deal at that time frame. If you're in a situation where you're saying, hey, if we don't make a deal, I'm just going to keep growing the business and your investment is going to get more and more expensive over time as the business continues to grow, suddenly the optionality swings back in your favor as the entrepreneur. Because one thing I think entrepreneurs don't think about is, imagine you're an entrepreneur that was very successful and you made $300 million. You got to be thinking, what am I going to do with this $300 million? Yeah, you'll buy a few nice houses, maybe get a Ferrari and a boat. Who knows? Maybe you even drop $5 million on a jet. But the rest of that money, which is probably like 270 out of the 300 million, you know, if you're in California, a bunch of that's going to go to taxes, but a bunch is going to be left that you have to deploy. And you're looking for a spread in your portfolio. And some of that is probably going to go to either individual investments that you make, which is, you know, like something you do, Mark, or you're going to be an LP or a limited partner in a VC fund or a private equity fund or, you know, whatever it is. Now, of course, you're going to use some of that money to buy up real estate and, you know, mutual funds and, you know, bonds and stuff that are like safe investments, quote unquote. But there's a huge amount of dry powder out there. I've heard some estimates as high as $2 trillion in private equity that's sitting on the books right now looking for a home. That is an unbelievable amount of dry powder to get deployed. And that means that entrepreneurs can potentially be in the driver's seat when it comes to raising capital. And right now is actually a really good time to raise capital. So, you know, it's really about optics and dynamics, because it's a deal. You're trying to make a deal with somebody for investment in your business. And the, you know, again, going back to that word, the optionality you have, like Chris said, is going to be absolutely critical in determining your negotiating strength going into the discussion with investors.
And I think full disclosure too, I am a very minority share holder in both companies. So I'm a small investor in Aqua Oso and Trifecta Nutrition. So, but Chris, as I think about this for Greg and you in terms of like raising money, but yet you're also simultaneously building businesses, how do you divide your time? I mean, there's only 24 hours a day. So how do you sort of split the, and Greg's getting ready to have a kid. So how do you split that up?
Yeah, I don't know how you've dealt with this, Greg, over the past, but like I'm continuing to learn how to balance that, to be honest. Like I think in a perfect world, you set up a 3 or 4 month program, you go through a process, you raise your money. As a founder, as the CEO, like 99% of your time is on the fundraising efforts because it takes a ton of time. In reality, at least for me, it's been 50, 50, 20, 80, all over the map, right? Like running a business, having co-founders, running a team, hiring people, dealing with customers. Like, especially at our size, we're like 12 people. Like taking one person out of the business full-time has a real impact on the entire business. So I've been in and out, and what I found though, every time I'm in the business and I'm not fundraising, the fundraising becomes even harder.
So it's kind of like a sprint, a 90-120 day sprint, and then you're back to a year or two of you know, total all in on execution of the business.
Yeah, and I've got some co-founder friends, and they've been able to do that really well. They've been able to execute around 90-day programs. All they do is fundraising. They go have the 400 discussions that it takes to get the deal done. And then they go back into the business. I'm still working on that. That's part of my growth path.
Well, Greg, I would ask you the same question. And then I also would like you to tell us, because a lot of early stage companies don't even know what early stage entrepreneurs haven't really contemplated using an investment banker. So maybe how do you divide up your time? And then does the investment banker take a little bit of the load off of you now that you're at that level?
Oh God, yes. I mean, I tell people like as soon as they're, it's really hard to engage an investment bank at the early stage because they make their money off what's called a success fee. Full disclosure, for our $60 million round, William Blair would get a 5% success fee, which is $3 million. That's a cool amount of change for them to make, helping us raise the money. Now they've assigned 6 partners and 3 analysts to work our account. So as you can imagine, those six managing directors, they're already well-known rich guys who got loads of very close relationships on Wall Street and Sand Hill. They're able to immediately walk us into 75 plus private equity firms. And, you know, the other side of the coin when it comes to optionality, I'll bring that word up again, is you're much better off if you have more horses in the race. So, you know, we'll hopefully get 50-ish NDAs back when we start the process. Then from there, it'll go down to, you know, hopefully 30, 40 fireside chats, which will result in, you know, hopefully 10 to 15 bids that will narrow down to five or six serious bids, hopefully get term sheets from all of them and select the, you know, the partner that we think makes the most sense for us. You know, we have great rapport and really like the team because they're a partner after that. They're going to be on your board, you know, working day to day with you. And at the same time, being a, you know, being a situation where we're getting, you know, the best terms. So obviously we're able to negotiate better terms if we have multiple players in the equation. So an investment bank is really, you know, their nickname is an advisor, but they do this all day long, every day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They're usually working a few deals at a time. They're usually specialized in a specific niche, whether it's consumer or software or e-commerce or medical or, you know, whatever. They know the private equity and venture capital firms in that space, and they're able to walk you in the door immediately. So you're not pitching an analyst, then pitching a partner, and then eventually pitching a managing director. You're like, whack, we won't even talk to you unless I've got all the managing directors of the firm on the phone call, because my time is the valuable time in this equation. So I highly, highly recommend them. They're incredibly good at compressing a process into 90 days. I feel Chris's pain. In the beginning, you're just, you know, you're trying to get 50 G's here, 100 G's there. It's, you know, it's a constant process. But in terms of time split, you know, I'll probably be 60-40, 60% running the business, 40% fundraise, you know, going through this, because the investment bankers are able to take so much weight off my shoulders. And, you know, it probably makes sense to engage them north of a $10 million raise. And they can also be hugely, what they're hoping is you're going to continue to grow and they can stick with you as the business grows. And then they help you and advise you on your M&A transaction or your IPO or whatever it is, because that's where the big bucks are for them. You know, their success fee as a percentage will go down to 1 or 2%, but, you know, 1 or 2% of $1 billion is, you know, a hell of a lot of money. So, yeah. Highly recommend them. I recommend learning as much as possible about them, but they do take a lot of the pressure off the entrepreneur, because it's like, you know, a third party intermediary. If a private equity firm has some concern about me that they're not willing to tell me, the investment banker can probably figure out what it is, and I can go into the next conversation allaying those concerns. It makes the overall process much, much easier and much more streamlined.
So optionality, I think there's a lot of people out there at these earlier stages that maybe don't have as many choices yet, right? They haven't earned the choices. And you start thinking about these early stage, you get the friends and family who are kind of come in, usually just because they love you, I guess, and believe in you, and they want what's best for you. But once you start getting into the angel investor realm, or maybe the seed stage, where you're beginning to take, you're choosing which partner, Chris, Greg, you had to choose which partners in the early days, with less choices. But there's can be some horror stories in there too, if you make the wrong choices. And sometimes what I have seen is people taking advantage of the early entrepreneur with, what some people might think is predatory type of terms, and really things that may come back to haunt you a little bit later as you go on to get these other rounds. And so I'm kind of wondering, Chris, how did you go about choosing this this latest partner? And I mean, do you feel like it's set up so that you can go raise those next rounds without you know, a lot of hair on the offering?
Yeah, I, you know, we went into this round really, really clear on what we were looking for in terms of the type of investor that we were looking for, the kind of money that we were looking for, what kind of growth that would get us, but also what would the next round potentially look like. So we set this round up in anticipation of what a Series A round would look like. So anytime there was there was a topic that like might mess up a Series A round, we had really good discussions around that with this particular investor and said, you know what, like, I get why you're asking for that, but we need to do it a different way because otherwise we're putting the Series A round at risk. And I think that kind of goes back to the education component of understand like this round and the next round, how they all tie together. And like, we have a really great attorney. Like attorneys are like a really good attorney is just a godsend. Like he was super great at helping us go through some of these really, cause they can be tough, right? Hard discussions. You're talking to an investor that you know is going to be on your board for into perpetuity. And you're on different sides of the table during the negotiations, knowing you're going to be on the same side of the table afterwards. So it's an interesting dance that you have to do, but being really clear on what you're looking for. We've said no to plenty of investors over the last few years. Like, you know, we've had the conversations like gut check, is this person good? No, like, why would I want to take their money? And even a few times we're like feeling desperate, like, maybe we should, but I think you just have to have the wherewithal at some point to say no when it just doesn't feel right. And know the things that are going to be a problem later on down the road. So like, I don't think that any entrepreneur that's raising money gets a get out of jail free card for not understanding the terms of their term sheet. Like, you have to know it, and you have to know what they mean going into the deal. You know, you raised up a book, Greg. I'll raise one as well. The Venture Deals book by Brad Feld, like, fantastic piece of work. It goes through all of the components, what to look for, what not to look for, what the balancing is, because at the end of the day, you're looking for a good balance and a good partner. In addition to the money,
it really does take on the entrepreneur's perspective, and they're kind of, it almost feels like the authors of that book are on your side, right? You're like, they're in it with you.
Yeah.
Well, good stuff. So, as you know, we only have a little bit more time, and I want to make sure you have a chance really to share where you're going, you know, what the long term is for your vision. And then also, I want to hear about Sacramento, right? And why did you choose to build a company in Sacramento? Is it a disadvantage? Is it an advantage? Is there a way together we can create what I call a proximity advantage? Because I believe there is, but I want to kind of hear your thoughts, because I think in many ways we are underestimated here in Sacramento. And sometimes it's for good reason, but I think sometimes the dark horse can be one of the best places to put your bet. So Greg, you want to start us with that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, I mean, you know, I love this topic. I'm probably Sacramento's second biggest cheerleader behind you. But yes, I think there's definitely pros and cons of Sacramento. Big pros are that, you know, the real estate isn't expensive. I mean, I'm obviously, you know, sitting in the penthouse in the middle of, you know, downtown. There's probably no way we could afford this if we were in San Francisco. It'd be well over $100,000 a month for what we have here. But, you know, ultimately, I do think there are big advantages. We're very close to Silicon Valley. That gets easy access to investment bankers, Sand Hill. You know, you get that kind of Northern California halo effect. Obviously, there's a mass exodus going on from the Bay Area to Sacramento right now. Some estimates are as high as 23,000 people a month are moving to Sacramento from the Bay Area. So we're able to attract a lot of talent, you know, from that perspective. That being said, I think, you know, Sacramento was kind of a sleepy government and real estate town for a long time. So it really hasn't changed until about 4 years ago when they redid the DoCo. I've got the stadium right outside my window right now. I think when the other new stadium goes in for the MLS team, the Republic, and the Rail Yards gets built out, at that point, there will definitely be Sacramento is the growth city in California and is here to stay vibe going on, especially as we pull out of the pandemic. We've obviously got a lot of other talent attracting elements. I'm a big Napa junkie. I live in Davis. It's like a 35-minute trip for me to go to Napa. Love Tahoe. Love the weather here. I mean, we're in, you know, February 4th or whatever it is, and it's like a bright sunny day outside. So bright you can barely see the skyline behind me. So so yeah, a ton of pros. You know, I think a few cons in that we're still growing, you know, which we're going to have to kind of rebuild that reputation as the company continues to scale, or the city continues to scale. But overall, we've been thrilled to come back. You know, my goal is to build a massive company right here in downtown Sacramento that has, you know, thousands of employees, and I make a whole lot of people very rich through their, you know, incentive stock options that they have as employees, and they go on to start their own companies, buy houses, cars, boats, frequent restaurants, really, really help continue to grow the thriving economy in the Sacramento region. I think that can be my, I think you're kind of tackling it at the early stage entrepreneur level. I'm trying to put a Facebook or a Google right smack dab in the middle of the city. And I think the combination of those two things, we can really kind of fill in the gap and make Sacramento the powerhouse that I think we both know it's going to be in the next few years.
I love that vision. And you know, the one thing that I did not hear you say was a concern that I hear a lot, and I think it's a little bit of the subject of today's show, is the access to capital. You've been raising money from your customers for a long time, but you've occasionally decided to go out and raise money, and our proximity to investment dollars, it's only 90 minutes away. Some people complain that that's too far. I'm not hearing you make that as an excuse.
I think that's a false objection if you're getting that from an investor in San Francisco. It's an hour drive from my headquarters to San Francisco. It is absolutely not too far. It probably takes just as long to get to Fremont. So it's definitely something that we haven't had difficulties with. And with the pandemic, we talked to investment bankers at the beginning of the pandemic, and they're like, the VCs and private equity guys, they don't know what to do in the beginning. They only do deals after they've met people face to face. And after 45 to 60 days, Zoom deals were getting done. You know, people were doing deals without ever meeting face to face. So I think that's really changed the dynamics of the market. I think it doesn't matter where you are. I think there's a lot of people moving all over the country because they can work remotely right now. And, you know, maybe that'll change after we pull out of the pandemic. But, you know, in the short term, I don't think it matters where you're at. And I think being in Northern California gives us some of that San Francisco halo effect as is.
I think you make a great point. I'm involved in some other businesses too. Our concrete business, you know, we do some residential sort of driveways and patios. That business is blowing up. My daughter in her real estate business, the things I'm doing in real estate, blowing up in residential real estate. So I can feel the influx of these tech workers, this migration of people coming in. And these are great people for talent for Trifecta. I think talent for Chris and Aqua Oso, they're customers of some of our businesses. So I think in many ways, COVID has created this sort of tailwind for Sacramento in a way. But so Chris, I'm going to turn it back over to you. Longer term vision for Aqua Oso. Why Sacramento? Any regrets?
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to build a global platform to address a really hard, complex problem around water resiliency. And it takes a very specialized team, but you have to go build a scalable piece of software around it. So our challenges are going to be finding technologists and software engineers and data specialists and experts in water to go solve this problem at global scale. I think my opinion of Sacramento has been changing over the last year. Like if you asked me this a year ago, and you did, I'm on the fence, right? Around, I don't know, can I really scale in Sacramento? The tech talent is like kind of here, but not really. It's still in the Bay. The knowledge around building technology companies is definitely still in the Bay or in Austin or like some of these other hubs where it's just naturally been building up. I think with the pandemic, we're seeing a major shift, right? Like people are migrating out of the Bay Area. They're trying to find new places to work. They're, you know, you're seeing the co-working spaces in the area starting to explode and like more people coming to the area. But at the same time, it's also opened up the door to hire people that aren't geographically near you. Like I am now the only like full-time employee in Sacramento, in the region. The rest of our team is fully dispersed in Fresno, in Denver, in Alabama. Like we're all over the place now. So like, I'm not sure how it's actually going to grow. I bounce back and forth between like staying fully remote and the power though of having a team centrally located to make, you know, really good executive types of decisions and team building. So we're still working through that. I think like a lot of companies are. I've raised money from angels in Sacramento, which has been great. But I've also raised money like the seed round. I've never met in person these investors. Like we've had plenty of Zoom conversations, phone calls, haven't met in person yet. I'm looking forward to it, right? I'm looking forward to board meetings where we're in person. But I think the world has definitely changed in terms of how you build a company, and it accelerated how you build companies, whether it's here or elsewhere. And I think to the conversation that you were having before I even joined around, you know, what are the types of groups that you can hang out with? I think that matters the most. Like who's the cohort of folks you can hang out with to continue growing and developing as a CEO, as a leader, as an entrepreneur. And I think for me early on, Sacramento was really light on that ability of like, who's built a really strong SaaS business right, in Sacramento, and there's like a handful of folks, right? But you go to the Bay or you go to Austin, you go, there's everyone, right? You bump into people that have that experience. So I think for me, being able to just continue to connect with the people that can help us build and grow the business, that's the most important element, at least for us at this stage.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Nobody builds a truly great company alone. And I believe that we are, that the time is now. I agree that over the last several years, we've been underestimated, but some nice seeds have been planted, right? A lot of good things have begun to happen. And Greg, you mentioned some of those. And I think the one thing that proximity can do, that I think a Zoom call has a tougher time doing, is really providing that immediate trust. If you run into somebody at Disneyland and you're in line, you're like, oh, you're from Sacramento. Oh, hey, there's an interesting immediate connection, right? It's like, it's more possible because you're from the same hometown, right? There's a connection that is sort of like almost like surprising. And I think that can happen by proximity a little bit easier than by industry, in my opinion. And I've seen that happen. And I think, Greg, you and I have seen this in the entrepreneurs organization, right? It might start with, hey, I know this person, and a kind of an interesting instant bond or a trust factor can really turn into love, right? Where that's my brother, right? That's my brother from another mother or my sister. The love quotient, which sounds a little squishy, I think matters when you're building something like a truly great company and you're going to war together in order to get something done. And I think it can happen remotely, but it happens more organically if you know that person face to face. And I think, Greg, it reminds me of something that you did that I'm going to share real quickly. And I think it's because we know each other, right? I was an early investor in a trifecta. Hopefully I helped make a few connections that were helpful, brought you into EO, and you began helping everybody. But the story that I think of, that one of the stories that makes me love you, Greg, is a story that happened just a year or two ago where my nephew got testicular cancer. And you had caught wind of that and said, hey, you know what might be healthy or helpful or a combo is some trifecta nutrition to this guy who's going through radiation and chemo, right? We got a firefighter, Iraqi Marine, badass dude. Now he's laid up, right? In a really bad way. He starts downing his subscription to trifecta nutrition that Greg provided generously. And today he's cured, right? So this is my nephew that went through the most trying time of his life, probably even compared to getting shot at in Iraq. And it's like he survived it. And he survived it because Greg loved me at some level. I love Greg. And now that thing shares to somebody in our network. And I don't think those kind of bonds are as easy to make happen when you're thousands of miles away, but it can happen when you're all in one backyard together. And I think it's an advantage that the proximity effect of Sacramento can have and will have as we begin to get a little bit of this traction that you two talked about. So I think we're on the beginning of something pretty special. I'm lucky to be a small investor in your guys' companies. Lucky to call you friends, proud to have you in my backyard of Sacramento. And I look forward to seeing you grow great things with Aqua Oso, with Trifecta Nutrition. And really, when you guys win, Sacramento wins. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having us on. And yeah, I do remember the story about your nephew. While I'm married to a doctor, and I'd say the doctors probably take at least as much credit as Trifecta, glad we were able to help there. We try and help in as many kind of situations with the community and, friends and family as possible. Absolutely. So you do amazing work. Obviously, you're kind of the tip of the spear for the entrepreneurial community in the region. So you are greatly appreciated by all of us. And yeah, I agree. I think we've got something cool going on in Sacramento that is hard to replicate and doesn't happen very often, where you've got that kind of groundswell of entrepreneurship and growth and optimism in a community that's, that's, you know, got a big influx of people coming in. You know, we're the fastest growing big city in California, one of the fastest in America. And that excites me. I'm excited to see what happens over the next 3 to 5 years. And we appreciate your leadership making it happen for, you know, people like Chris and myself.
You betcha. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Yeah. Thank you both. And, again, this is a gift to Sacramento, to the next guy in line. So thank you for what you guys have brought to the show today.
Yeah. Sounds good. Mark. Thanks, Mark. Talk
All
to
right.
you soon.
Thanks, guys. See ya.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.